This has been an interesting month. I'm sort of a, well, not sort of, I am sort of a curious people watcher. I love to pay attention to people and to think about the variety of individuals and human beings in the world, and so many different things catch my attention and wonder where this person, what their story is, and that's just the way my mind works. And so sometimes I love to, when I'm out in public, just to kind of watch and see how people react and how they do things and wonder in my heart and my soul a little bit about what they're like. I don't know if you do that. I just, the way my weird mind works. And the incidences that occur and, you know, provoke my thinking. And one of my, it's hard for me to get out of it, but I just can't help it. I just mull and think and muse on the interesting waves and flows of life for human beings. And this has been an interesting month here at the church. We've had three memorial services this month, which is a little bit more than normal for our church. And I thought back over those three. We've had two this past week, Friday and Saturday, one earlier in the month. And the stories around, you know, you go to one of the memorial services, and one of the parts that's the most intriguing and uplifting for me is when people share remembrances and stories. And there, you'll hear a story of an individual, and you go, wow, I didn't know that about that person. And even people I thought I really knew a lot, sometimes there would be stories that would come out, and you go, man, I just had no idea that this was what this life was all about, and the things that God had taken them through. And so you start to realize, wow, there's so many different paths and stories in this world. Then this past week, I read a newsletter from one of our missionaries who lives on the other side of the world in a country that's pretty hostile to the gospel. And he's telling stories of what's happening there, and I begin to think, man, what would it be like to be those people who are being persecuted for their faith and run out of their homes, and they had to go to an island away from their own home base, and they don't know when they're even going to be able to return home, all because they are believers in Jesus. And I go, I wonder what it would be like to be that. And then I think, you know, Ginger has a picture on a nightstand next to her bed, on her side of the bed, of the girl in Thailand that she got to be with to teach English to when they were there last summer, who's come to Christ and whom she prays for every day. And then I'm reminded about those girls that are caught up in that world. And I wonder, man, can you imagine what it would be like? And I think about different cultures and different places and different stories and all these different trajectories and all these different amazing story of human life and all of its variances. And one of the things I ask, is there anything that can bring all that together? Is there anything in all of the universe and all of the world that sort of ties the needs of all those life stories that are so disparate and so crazy and often isolated, but sometimes interwoven? What is it that brings all, is there a story? Now, one of the things that in our, quote, postmodern world is that there's come to be a great skepticism that there's any one narrative, any one idea, any one system of thought, any one religious perspective that's absolutely true or covers the whole gamut of the story of human life. And so it's been trendy, or the path that most people have taken in the last generation or so, to say, you know, there's my truth and there's your truth, and you can have your truth and I can have my truth. Because after all the big stories that people claim to be the answer haven't really worked out. So we're left in a day and an age that says, is there really anything that takes all of that diversity and problems in the world and brings it underneath one idea or story that says this is the answer? Now, as people who are followers of Jesus, we are challenged by that, to think about that and wonder what can we speak into that. And I would suggest to you that Jesus walked in a time that, while culturally and historically different, had elements of the human condition that were prevalent, just like that mirrored what we see today. And into that, he spoke a narrative. He spoke a story of what God was doing, that he presented to us and says, this is the way. We've been looking at it together in this for over a year now in the Gospel of Luke. And in this current season of looking at Luke, we've called this section, Your Kingdom Come. What does it mean that God's kingdom is present among us? And we talked about these two ideas of the relentless love of God and his call for us to resolute living in response to that love. And as Jesus is teaching his disciples and challenging the people of his day, they consider anew the heart of God and what it means to be a true follower of God. We try to enter in and say, God, teach us about that. And last week we came to Luke chapter 15, which I consider now to be the most, for me personally anyway, at this stage in my life, has become the most important chapter in all the Bible. And if you said you can only take one chapter with you wherever you go, what would you take? I'd take Luke 15. Because in it, Jesus opens his heart. He opens and tells the story that's most profoundly needed, and he tells it in a graphic and beautiful story form. Now, last week we looked at a portion of that. He answers a question. In Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2, it sets the stage. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." That's the problem, the setting of this chapter. Jesus continued to extend his love and his grace to people who were marginalized and looked down on in his society, the tax collectors and sinners. These Pharisees and scribes who considered themselves the custodians of truth, the ones who had the real truth, the ones who were the holders of the cultural keys to the nation of Israel and thus to God's heart, but had twisted and turned that truth into ways that were self-protective and self-promoting, and they loved their positions, and they loved their authority on people's lives. They loved the prestige that came with them being sort of the scholars and experts and rulers of the lives of people. And Jesus saw that they had twisted the heart of God and the message of God into a system of rules that gave them position and power, but overlooked the needs of hearts like those publicans and sinners, those tax collectors and sinners that he enjoyed hanging out with. And so in response to their criticism of him, their grumbling at him that he would touch and live among and eat with these sinful people, he says, "I'm going to tell you a story." And the story had three parts, and we looked at the first two parts last week. In the first two parts, he tells a story of a shepherd who had 100 sheep and lost one, who at great cost to himself goes and finds the lost sheep to bring it back into the fold. Then he tells a story of a woman who's caring for the household budget and has 10 coins, which was about a third of a month's salary, and she loses one, the equivalent of a day's wages. And in that dark house that she lived in, she lit a lamp and she searched diligently till she found the coin. Once again, at great cost and at great effort, that which is lost is found by someone. And in response to that, there's great rejoicing in the community. And all of those two stories, as profound as they are, set up the fleshing out of this and if you will, where Jesus seeks to put the dagger and a little twist it a little bit into the hearts of these Pharisees and scribes who need to get a fresh view of God's grace. And so he tells a new story to them, a story that's been depicted in art, a story that's been sung about and talked about, and a story that's been mistitled for centuries as the story of the prodigal son. And that's a bad title. That's the one we know the story about because it's an incomplete title. So what we're going to do today, I'm going to read that whole story to you. So it'll take a few minutes. It's a little bit of a longer story. I want you to sit and listen to the story as it unfolds. And then we just want to walk back and we want to think about, there's two acts in this play. There's an act one and an act two in this story. And each of these stories, there's cycles of rebellion, grace, and restoration. And we want to look at read the story and then consider those cycles that Jesus, and what it means for us and for all of us as human beings. So follow along with me. Again, this story in verse 11 of chapter 15. And here's how Jesus tells the story. And he said, "There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they begin to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what those things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. And his father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. Now, let's take these look at this story. Here's what happens. In Act 1, there's a man, two sons. He has some holdings. He's probably one of the wealthier men in the village from the description of all that happens, the landed estate, the parties that will be held. It seems this family is a family of some means, a prominent family in the village. He has two sons, the younger of which is just, you know, he's tired of living in his father's house. And so he asks for his part of the inheritance. Now, think for a minute. In this particular culture of that day, the dispersal of the inheritance only came at the death of the father. For the younger son to come into his father's presence and ask, demand for his portion of the inheritance was an incredible insult to his father. It was paramount to saying, far as I'm concerned, I wish you were dead. I want my stuff. I don't care about you. I don't care about this family. All I want is my stuff. I want to go. I'm tired of this. And so now, the father had some options at this point. He could have banished the son. He could have done a lot of things. The single most unlikely thing for this father to do was to grant the request. But he does. And he goes ahead and divides the inheritance. By law, 2/3 of it would have gone to the older son, and that younger son would have gotten 1/3. And so the father goes ahead, even though he's nowhere near death, and says, okay, I'll go ahead and grant your request. Here it is. Here's your inheritance. The younger son heads out. Now, it says he goes out, and the inheritance would have been mostly resided in property, land, the holdings, the animals, the things were there. Those aren't the kind of things you can take to a far country, which means he would have had to dispose of those goods, sell them off. It was another slam in his family's face, because not only has he now asked for his portion of the inheritance, he is further shaming his father by going in the local community and trying to sell off those goods, which means now everybody in the community is absolutely aware of what this younger son is doing for his father. And he takes that money that he earns off of that, and he heads off, and it says he loses it in wasteful living, expensive living. We don't know exactly what he did. His brother will later accuse him of all kinds of things. His brother has no idea what he did with it. But he actually, the word there is expensive living, lavish living. And all of a sudden, it's all gone. Hard times, economic times come. Some of you may understand that. You get the boom time comes, you spend your money, and all of a sudden the economic downturn comes, you lose a job, and all of a sudden, oh, what am I going to do now? Well, that's where this younger son was. But this far country obviously was a Gentile land, because where he finds himself is with a person who he turns to as a person who has a pig farm. So not only has this younger son squandered his inheritance in expensive living, he squandered his inheritance in expensive living among Gentiles. This is an important part of the story. So what happens is he goes there and he's getting hungry. He goes to work for these pig farmers. He's not paying many things. I guess you can eat whatever you can get out of the pig trough. And so he starts to eat the husks of the pig food, and he's starving. And then in verses 17 to 19, here's what we hear him say. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I'll arise and go to my father, and I will say to him." Now, he's rehearsing the speech. Here's what he's going to tell his dad. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." Now, often when we read this parable, we think, oh, here's the moment where he repents. That's not so. This is not the moment in the story where his heart has changed. This is the moment in his story where he's still looking out for one thing. How am I going to get food in my belly? He's not worried about how he shamed his father. He's not worried about anything. So he concocts a plan. That I came to himself, all right, I got a plan here. He's still conniving. He's still thinking. The hired servants, now these aren't the slaves that lived in the land. Hired servers were day workers. They were skilled craftsmen who had come in to do certain particular tasks. They were sort of the consultants of the day on whatever needed to be done around the place. And those are trained, skilled craftsperson. They were hired for specific jobs. And here the prodigal knows, these guys, they eat better than what I'm eating here. Okay, I am going to go back to my father. I'm going to go back to him and ask him if he will treat me like one of those hired servants. Now, here's why he has to ask his father that. Because he has shamed his father, nobody in that community will hire him unless his father says it's okay. He knows he's got to somehow get on the good side of his father. And so as he's hitting rock bottom, he's trying to concoct a plan. Here's what he knows he's facing. There was a ceremony that had developed during that time in the Jewish history. It was called, and I don't know how to pronounce it properly, but it's called the Kazaza ceremony. It was a ceremony of banishment. Here's what he was facing when he came back to the city. If a person took inheritance or property, a Jew did that and went out and squandered it in a Gentile and gave that money to Gentiles. There was a ceremony when if he ever showed his face in town, the town would come out to meet him. They would bring a jar, this is a very dramatic thing, with burned corn and nuts in it, and break it in front of it and collectively shout his name and say, "We have nothing more to do for you, leave." And he would be run out of town. He knew that's what he was facing. So he said, "Here's what I'm going to do. The only way for me to save myself from and get back in, I need to get a job. I need to earn some money. I need to pay all this back. And if I can just get my dad to say, okay, I'm going to let you get a job, work this debt off, and pay the debt, then maybe I can get myself some food in my stomach and maybe get myself back in the good graces." So he heads home. At this point, he has one thought in mind. I've got to earn my way back to my father. I got to get a job. I got to pay the debt. I've got to take care of me. And then in verse 20, "And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him." This is the most, if you were to read this story, when Jesus first told this story, this would have been the moment in the story when there would have been a collective gasp. Because this is the most unusual behavior by a father. This son is now a long way off, and those communities were pretty tight, and even the ones that had larger states, if the father could see the son coming, the rest, other people could too. What's awaiting him is those people, a gauntlet of people who are ready to banish him forever from their presence in this village. And before he could even enter the city, the father gathers up his robes and runs. No gentleman of that era ever ran anywhere. To run in public was considered to be undignified. It was considered to be lowering yourself. And here, this prominent citizen, this father, humbles himself, gathers his robes, and rather than allow his son to run the gauntlet of shame in the community, runs to the edge of the community and meets his son. And not only meets him, but showers him with compassion, embracing him and kissing him. And in an act of personal humiliation and sacrifice, the father makes all the effort to go and meet the son. And then, in verse 21, the son responds, and the son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." What's different about the speech that he offers from the speech that he planned? Do you note it? He no longer says, "Let me get a job." He's crushed and broken by the compassion of his father. And his father says, "Bring the robe, bring the ring, kill the fatted calf." And it says they celebrated. And at this moment, this son has been found. When he allows, remember last week, for those of you here, that one of the great definitions of repentance that Jesus has given us in story is to let yourself be found. Can't earn your way back to God. Can't earn your way back out of the holes that we've dug from our brokenness and sin. But a compassionate, loving God has left heaven at great humiliation to himself and died on a cross to rescue us and embraces us with all the love and kisses of his mercy and grace. And what he asks for us is to let him put his robe around us and kill the fatted calf and welcome us home. And all of his energy had been designed. How can I earn my way back to my dad? How can I? And what he meets is a compassionate, loving God who says, "I have done the work to come meet you. Receive my grace." And that grace is extended. The celebration happens. He's restored to the community. He's restored to the family, to the father. And everyone's celebrating. End of Act 1. Act 2 begins. There's the older brother. He's out in the field. He hears all the story. He hears the party. And as he's headed back in, he hears the party going. What in the world? As he draws near, it gets louder and more raucous, and he hears that there's great celebration. And so he's inquisitively, it says, he asks a servant. That word there is the word for child. It's more likely that there were some kids playing outside. The servants are probably in helping serve the party, and this would be normal. The kids are playing around the periphery of what's going on. And so he grabs one of the little boys there and says, "Hey, what in the world is going on here? What's going on?" And the little boy, "Your brother's come home, and your father's killed the fatted calf, and your father has, we're celebrating because there's been a restoration. And we're all celebrating because of that." And then in verse 28, the story tells us that the older son was angry and refused to go in. But his father came out and entreated him. Now, by not entering into the party, the older son has now shamed his father like his younger brother had. To refuse to come in and be a co-host, to serve the guest of his father, to enter in, no matter what he thought about it, was an open act of rebellion against his father's gracefulness toward his brother. In his anger and in his pride, he stays outside, refuses to go in the party, and says, I don't care what my father says, I am not going in. And in just like in the moment when the father runs to meet the younger son as he returns from the far country, the father takes the initiative and goes out to where the older brother is. And the older brother, and the father tries to entreat him. And then in verse 29, he answered his father, "Look, these many years I've served you, and I've never disobeyed your command. You never gave me a young goat," although that's actually a lie, "that I might celebrate with my friends." The story starts with his dad giving him 2/3 of everything he owns. It's not true that his father had never given him anything. He'd given him almost all that he had. 2/3 of his property actually belonged to the older son now. "You've never done anything for me, and I've served you all these years." And in open rebellion and defiance of his father, a shouting match has now ensued. Can you imagine if you're hosting a party and one of your children or a loved one or someone came outside and said, "What in the world are you doing? I don't think what you're doing is wrong," and gets in a public shouting match with his father. And the shame still comes on the father. And what does the father do? He just asks him to come in. And what's his argument? "I've served you all these years. I've always done the right thing. I've worked hard. You owe me your grace. You owe this to me because of how good I've been. What a good son I've been." And the father keeps extending grace. "Come on in. Your brother was lost. Be restored to the fellowship of the family. Come back in yourself." And the father extends grace to this one as well. But in the cycle of rebellion and grace and restoration that we saw in Act 1 and Act 2, we have rebellion and grace and restoration. We don't know. He ends the story before it ends. Put yourself in the place of one of those Pharisees and scribes listening to this story. What Jesus has pointedly said to them, "Okay, now what are you going to do? You have shamed your father just like all these sinners that you put down. Your defiance, your unwillingness to live in relationship of love with your father, you have relied on your own goodness and your self-righteousness to say that you're better than everyone else and that you deserve God's blessing. And you have shamed your father just like these people that you talk down on. And yet your father, even in that, extends to you the same invitation of grace to come back into the fold." And Jesus stops the story right there. And we don't know how it ends. We don't know how it ends. But Jesus extends amazing grace. When we were far off, rebelling, when we were wherever, whichever camp we're in, the Father goes out to bring us back. The Apostle Paul in Romans 5, verse 8, says to us, "But God shows his love for us, and while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." The story that's in Luke 15 graphically illustrates this. And in so doing, it has set for us, given us a story that covers all of humanity. And while Jesus is speaking to some highly particular situations of self-righteous Pharisees and scribes and broken, sinful people who've lived far from God, in telling this story, he has universalized it to the point that he's covered just every one of us. For every one of us, in one way or another, fits into this story of these two sons. There are some of us in this auditorium today who know or feel that because of the way they've lived, there is no way that they are worthy of God's love. There are things in your life that you've done, things that you've questioned that bring great heartache and shame to you, and you wonder if there's anything you can ever do to get God to love you. And in the shame and the brokenness of your sinfulness, you wonder, is there any hope? What can I do? And the answer is you can't do anything except let yourself be found. That the God of grace and love, the Father, has come out to meet you. He's ready to put the ring on your finger and the robe around your shoulder. He's killed the fatted calf for you to celebrate that you've come home. And some of us have grown up with a lot of religious pride. Gone to church all my life, tried to do the right thing, didn't break any rules, or not too any big ones anyway. And compared to all those folks that are in this lifestyle or that, or committed this crime or that sin or whatever, you know, in the end of the day, I'm pretty good. Okay, I'm not perfect, but you know, I really feel like I've done the best that I could, and I, you know, God, here I am with my good, accept me. I've done everything you've asked of me. And the same God, it says, I don't want you just to keep all the rules. I want your heart. And I've come out to meet you too. And you, in your sense of goodness, need to understand that it's not about just following rules and doing good and looking good. It's about being in relationship with the Father. And it's about receiving my love. And that same God walks out to you and says, I am ready. I want you to come into the party too. To be reconciled to me and to be reconciled to your brother. I want you in the party too. I want to celebrate your coming home and coming back in the fold. Will you do that? In this one amazing story, Jesus has hit on the vastness of our own heart, because the truth is, for most of us, both of these sons reside. There are moments in my life when I have been so ashamed of my sin, I have said, God, I don't know how in the world you could ever accept me back. And there have been moments, you know, after all, I've been a pastor for 30 plus years and gone to Bible school and seminary and a missionary and all, and I can lay out my pedigree in my heart and mind and go, surely God must be blessing me because of all these things I've done for him. And the pride of my self-righteousness can run in there too. And for most of us, both sons reside in our hearts. And in both cases, what God asks us is to shed that selfishness, that self-righteousness, or even that desire to earn our way back to him, whichever is beating most strongly in our heart at any moment, and says, rest in my unchanging love. Let me find you and bring you home. This is the story of the gospel. I mentioned before that one of my favorite Bible scholars is a man by the name of Kenneth Bailey. In summarizing this story, he writes some profound words. Listen to them. Each son returns to the father either defining, the older son, or intending to define, the prodigal. His relationship to the father is that of a servant before a master. The father will not accept. He offers costly love to each out of his determination to have sons who respond to love rather than servants merely obeying commands. This is the gospel. This is the God we serve. This is what Christ has done for us. This means that there's an invitation to come home to fellowship with the living God open to every single one of us. This means to us that all we do as believers and followers of Christ, all the things that we encourage you to do to grow in your faith and serve whomever in whatever way possible, all these things we talk about, none of it is because we want to say, see God, how good we are. All of it has to be a response to a loving Father that we just want to extend that love to as many people as possible. And that open door is there for all of us. The Apostle Paul summed it up in Romans 3, verses 24 and 25, when he said for us, for all have sinned. The ones who think they've been good enough and the ones who think they could never be good enough. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified not by our efforts to earn it back or any pedigree of goodness, but by his grace as a gift to the redemption that is in Jesus Christ. This is our hope. This is the story of God.